all across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense for this Monday, April 10th. Hope y'all had a wonderful weekend, whatever the occasion. We had a wonderful Easter weekend at our house, a house full of family for Easter dinner, and it was awfully nice. 20 people we managed to host from both sides of our family, including a daughter and a couple of grandkids. And if that doesn't recharge the batteries, nothing does. And nothing quite says your grandkids are visiting like waking up to, you know, noticing that there's a three-year-old standing on your bed near the end of it naked, who's awake and ready and wants to wear something else. So we did. And then we made breakfast, and it was awesome. Coming up this morning, ungerrymandering Wisconsin. Let's make that a word, ungerrymandering. How could a Wisconsin Supreme Court under progressive control go about ungerrymandering our state? We talked to data scientist Sam Wong of the Princeton Gerrymandering Project. And he says two current U.S. Supreme Court justices, one liberal, one conservative, have already provided a blueprint for undoing the damage of the rigged Republican maps that we've been living under. Then in our second hour, a victory lap for moms. As we mentioned, the Supreme Court will be controlled by progressives for the first time in 15 years, starting this August, thanks in large part to moms and their allies who spread the word that nothing gets better until they pursue a higher level of civic engagement and community organizing. We'll talk to Nicole Slavin and Aaron Phillips of Motherhood for Good about continuing the momentum into areas such as the politicization of women's medication, which we had happen late in this week, where we had a Trump-appointed federal judge decide that he was smarter than the FDA and undid 20-plus years of approval for a particular medication for political and ideological reasons and a flimsy, at best, legal reasons. So that, if nothing else, is a reason for women and their allies to stay involved. And again, to get over the stigma that, you know, I don't really do politics. If you don't do politics, politics is going to do you. And so we look for ways to stay engaged, or at the very least to stay more informed on the issues long before the next election. We'll wrap things up with Terry Bell, our news director at Civic Media for the radio stations, talking about three things that you should know to start the week. If you'd like to reach us at some point today, 844-967-2789 or the Up North line, 715-388-7155. We'll get you to Aaron Zommers in our studio, or you can email us to radio at upnorthnewswi.com. Mr. Zommers, did you have yourself a nice holiday weekend?
I did. I ended up staying home because someone in my family was not feeling great and I didn't want to get sick. So I just stayed home. My Easter dinner was eggs and bacon. Uh-huh. And you know what? That's fine with me. It was easy. I just relaxed and watched Star Wars with my roommate, which, of course, the most Easterly activity.
Of course it is. Well, look, so many of us are having, I had ham and eggs for breakfast. I had ham sandwiches, you know, bacon and eggs, not far from it. You're right there in that Easter spirit, as it were. So, and I'm guessing you didn't hide any eggs from yourself or anything like that.
No, not this time.
Okay. I mean, you knew right where they were. So, okay, good to know. We will also wait for any updates on the killing of two police officers in Barron County, one from Chautauqua, one from Cameron, those communities just south of Rice Lake. The State Department of Justice is taking over that investigation, and we will be passing along any information of that as we get it, with our sympathies and condolences going out to the officers and to the communities around Cameron and Chautauqua. Before we head into the discussion on gerrymandering, a little later in this hour, I wanted to pass along just something to set the table for it, if you will. Janet Protasiewicz had a great big victory, you know, a 10-11 point victory. And so you could see where some people would say, well, maybe all this talk about gerrymandering is wrong. Maybe Wisconsin isn't gerrymandered if a progressive can win by that big of a margin. But bear in mind that gerrymandering is talking about the districts, the district where the lines are for electing legislators and members of Congress. You can't gerrymander a state. So you can still win a state big and yet not win a majority of districts. And we've talked about that in the past, how statewide, like Governor Evers got over 50% of the vote, and yet Republicans managed to get over 60% of the seats because of the way they drew the lines for themselves. Well, one of the folks I like to follow on Twitter, his name is Stephen Thorson, and he did a little work to see if the Protasiewicz 11-point win was enough to break through the GOP gerrymander. It was not. Even if voting for Dan Kelly meant a Republican would represent you in your assembly district and Protasiewicz meant a Democrat would, Janet Protasiewicz only won 48 of the 99 assembly districts. So she got 55% of the vote. So she beat Dan Kelly 55-45, roughly. But if you brought it down to the assembly district level, she would have actually lost 51-48. That should be the first indication that those lines are not fully representative of Wisconsin voters, and that's why they need to be changed. Not because, Democrats deserve that, but because Republicans abused the privilege of being able to draw those lines and did not drew them in a manner that was so skewed that even a 10-point victory, a blowout across the state, isn't enough to overcome it. So that's part of what we're talking about at the bottom of the hour. We'll start our next segment coming up with telling you about another big Brewers win and the Bucks getting set for the playoffs. That's all next on Up North News Radio. I don't know if it's a bad moon, but it's a very bright moon greeting you out there. It's a 6:15 on a Monday across Wisconsin. Welcome again to Up North News Radio. I'm Pat Kreitlow. Brewers beat the Cardinals 6-1 on Sunday and win 2 out of 3 games in that series. They had swept the Mets the series before that. They'd won 2 out of 3 from the Cubs to start the year. So things on the right track for the Brewers here so far. Willie Adames went 3-for-4 with a home run, a double, 3 RBIs. Christian Yelich had 3 hits and a solo home run. Freddie Peralta, I did not think he was going to make it to 6 innings. He came out for the 6th at 88 pitches. He came out for the 6th and pitched. It got up to 102 pitches. But again, got that full 6-inning start that you want to see from your starting pitcher these days. 7 strikeouts. He gave up 1 run, 4 hits, and 3 walks. The bullpen stepped in. The bullpen is now at 23 consecutive scoreless innings. Now the Brewers hit the road after that homestand, and they are going to be in Arizona starting tonight. Let me pull up my note here. It says, say 8:40 or 9:40. Must say 8:40. I'll have to double check. See what happens when you don't wear your readers this early in the morning. So 3 at Arizona, then 4 in San Diego over the next weekend, then 3 more in Seattle. It's a 10-game road trip. And so the Brewers don't have an off day until a week from Thursday when they come back from this West Coast road trip. And then they will begin a 9-game homestand. Wade Miley is pitching for the Brewers tonight. The Milwaukee Bucks already knew that they were in the postseason. They already knew they had the NBA's best record. They sat several of their starters. They lost to Toronto to end the regular season 121-105. But both teams already knew that they were in the postseason, and we might end up facing Toronto again in the playoffs. Now, I'm going to try to explain this because not everybody out there is an NBA fan. I'm not either. But I kept hearing about the play-in tournament, and I honestly never tried to explain how it works before. But here we go. Try me out. Aaron, if you have any questions along the way, let me know. You would think in a normal world, the playoffs would be the top 8 teams. And then the number 1 team would play the number 8 team. 2 would play 7, 3, 6, 5 versus 4, right? But they actually start out not with the top 8 teams, but with the top 10. And 7 and 8 are not assured of actually making the playoffs. 7 and 8 have to play like a mini tournament against 9 and 10. So between 7, 8, 9, and 10, conceivably, the 9 and 10 teams could be in the playoffs instead of the 7 and 8. So the 7 and 8 really have to prove that they belong. And so as a consequence, I can't tell you who the Milwaukee Bucks are going to play to start the playoffs because they're the number one team. But we don't know who the number 8 team is going to be yet. It could be Miami. It could be Atlanta. It could be Toronto. It could be Chicago. What's going to happen is that on Tuesday, number 7 Miami is going to play number 8 Atlanta. And then whoever wins is locked in as the number 7 seed. But the loser gets to play one more time. Stand by for that. The number 9 team plays the number 10 team. And then the winner of that 9-10 game plays the loser of the 7-8 game. And the winner of that game ultimately becomes the number 8 seed and goes to Milwaukee the following day. So games on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And then on Saturday, they start the actual playoffs with whoever the number 8 team is coming to Milwaukee to take on the Bucks there. It's interesting, but it's not drama. You want drama? Let's talk about the Minnesota Timberwolves. And I'm only bringing it up because I saw the video of how the Timberwolves wrapped up their regular season. Now, they are the number 8 seed currently. Again, that means they have two chances at the playoffs. They beat New Orleans yesterday, 113 to 108. But one of the teammates threw a punch at the other during heated words during a timeout. And then another player has been lost to a right hand injury after he appeared to punch a wall. So that's how things are going for the Minnesota Timberwolves, the team that is, in my mind, the most cursed team in NBA existence. I mean, from the very time that team first stepped on the court, you know, 30 some years ago, it seems they've been snake bit when it comes to really getting any plays. They've had some good moments with people like Kevin Garnett, but boy, they can't get it done all the way. So they will be at least playing this week for a game or two, and then the full round of playoffs will begin on Saturday. All right, let's get back to some of the news here. We left off on Friday talking about how in Tennessee, Republican lawmakers decided to expel two of their members. They happen to be Democratic members, of course. They were black men. They had a chance to expel a white Democratic woman, and somehow they did not vote to expel her, but did kick out the other two. Well, to fill those seats temporarily, both the city of Nashville and one of the counties, Shelby County, the county commission, have to vote on who's going to fill the seats. You know who's going to fill the seats? The two guys they kicked out. Nashville officials are all set to vote today to reinstate one of those colleagues, and the Shelby County Commission could vote tomorrow to put in the other. Representatives Justin Jones and Justin Pearson were allegedly kicked out of the legislature for breaching decorum because they had the audacity to protest in the chamber the Republicans who would do nothing in the wake of the Covenant School shooting in Nashville. Republicans said to them, well, if you want something done, you know, put in a bill. You may as well put in thoughts and prayers. They've all done just as much good. And so the Capitol was all but swarmed with young people and their allies, essentially begging the Tennessee legislature to do something. But of course, that was going to fall on deaf ears. So some of it was begging. Some of it was just expressing outright anger. And so what did Republicans do about it? They got angry. And they kicked out two of the black men who were protesting gun violence. So now you have the Nashville Council and the Shelby County Commission will almost certainly reappoint Jones and Pearson to their seats. They still have to schedule special elections, and both Jones and Pearson are likely to run in the special election. Now, the rules in the Tennessee legislature say you can't be expelled twice for the same offense. But who thinks they're not going to try to expel them again? As a friend of mine put it, they'll find a reason. It's the old taillight defense, you know, the old broken taillight from a darker time in the South though it's still about as dark there as any other time when it comes to what public officials are willing to do to communities and people of color and what they're willing to not do to save their own children's lives. Meanwhile, in Texas, there's a new outrage, and it's sad to even describe it before I've told you about it as an outrage, but when you hear about it, you're going to understand why people are very concerned about what has happened to the grand old party in the United States. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, said over the weekend, practically hours after a man was convicted of murdering a protester, somebody protesting against police violence, nearly hours after that conviction, Texas Governor Greg Abbott said he's going to seek to pardon the man. And he also criticized the prosecution's office that secured the conviction. Again, this was somebody protesting police violence who was killed. Now, the protester, Garrett Foster, was armed himself. He was carrying an AK-47. He was killed by a man who shot him with a handgun. And the Texas governor is somehow claiming that the man with the handgun, who was in a car and could have driven away, that he should not have been convicted because of so-called stand your ground defenses. So again, it's okay if you're going to murder somebody who is protesting police violence. Because again, in Wisconsin, Kyle Rittenhouse never faced consequences for his actions. And so it has happened again. And not only are Texas Republicans supportive of the murderer, they're looking to engage in jury nullification, to essentially overrule a jury of his peers who convicted the person with the handgun of killing the legally armed protester. So I have a question. There's all this talk about, you know, that there should be legal open carry. And in Texas, there is. That man who was killed, both of them white men, by the way, the man who was killed was legally armed. There is dispute over whether he had raised his AK-47 toward the man with the handgun. The prosecution said he did. Most witnesses said that he did not. Well, I'm sorry, I should say the defense said that he did. Most witnesses say that he did not. That essentially this person who did the killing went into the city on purpose, claiming that he wanted to disrupt or do some harm to the people who were protesting police violence. I want you to note the way that I framed this all throughout this when I talked about the people protesting police violence. If I had said at the very beginning of this that they were protest, that it was a Black Lives Matter protester, instantly you could feel the polarization creep in, because people have been opposed to protesters and using Black Lives Matter almost as a pejorative, because they don't like what they're saying, doing, disrupting. And if you take that out of it, and if you just take it that people are upset about racism and police violence, some people will think differently than if we say it was a Black Lives Matter protester. You need to take those things out of it. Much like the Tennessee legislature, is it really about decorum? Or is it that you're not willing to do anything there about school shootings? In those cases and in other cases that we outlined on Friday with Carolyn Fiddler, we're finding that whether it's in Kansas with genital inspection of kids who want to play sports, or you know what is happening with politicizing abortion medications or what have you, you have people that are continuing to be upset over the actions of what has become a far-right party. And yet we still have too many people who are turning a blind eye to it. And the most recent example in national media of turning that blind eye comes from Judy Woodruff, who was on public television for forever. And she is writing, she's written a column for PBS saying, "America is as divided today as it's been in a very long time. I want to know why." And journalist Soledad O'Brien helps out. "Maybe it's because polls show Americans overwhelmingly support stricter gun laws, abortion rights, and meanwhile, an increasingly far-right government is not standing for the things that a majority of Americans stand for. The division is not equal. This is not a both sides say or do thing. And our national newsrooms need to figure that out." We will have Sam Wong coming up next from the Princeton Gerrymandering Project. You're up north. Professor Wong, thank you so much for joining us on Up North News Radio. We appreciate it.
Pleasure to be here.
Do you mind telling me first, before we get into the details of your suggestions for Wisconsin, what's your own interest in this as somebody at Princeton? When did you first become aware of this? When did it pique your curiosity?
Well, as director of the Electoral Innovation Lab and the Gerrymandering Project here, I have worked with my team to develop statistical measures to measure fairness in democracy. And so the idea here that we've worked on at the Gerrymandering Project is that when you get into these fights about what's a fair map, we believe that it's possible to come up with quantitative, fair, impartial metrics to determine exactly who a party favors on a map. And our general goal is to describe fairness and unfairness in representation across America.
One of those things that sounds obvious to the layperson, why wouldn't you be fair? Understanding at the same time that gerrymandering has been a part of American history, and yet it feels different more recently. It just feels more partisan, which is why we're getting into the topic of a partisan gerrymander versus, you know, the racial gerrymandering that folks might have been used to for the decades prior. And so just to make sure we're establishing things correctly here, it's your belief, it certainly is mine, that partisan gerrymandering in the past, you know, decade or so has gone to a level like we've never seen before?
Yes, absolutely. Partisan gerrymandering has been with us for a long time. Ever since the first gerrymander, named after Elbridge Gerry back in 1812, parties have long sought to get an advantage over the other side. But in the modern age of voting rights, like say the last 60 or 70 years, when we understand that one person should have one vote, when we understand that all citizens should have some kind of voice, in the modern era of voting rights, gerrymandering of a partisan nature got the worst it ever got in 2010 in half a dozen states across America. And it became a principal tool by which one party could gain dominance over the other party. And Wisconsin is right at the front of the class when it comes to that kind of offense.
So let's set up the legal case behind this again, not the Supreme Court race. We've heard about that. Janet Protasiewicz was the victor. She cited the way that the maps are rigged. Let's go back to the legal case, because it's kind of like, you know, Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones. Sometimes they made you wait like 2 years to pick up where we left off. So if you'll forgive me for sounding like an announcer on a soap opera, you know, previously on Gil v. Whitford, this case from Wisconsin went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court essentially said, we at the federal level are not going to define a partisan gerrymander, but if you guys at the state level want to figure it out, try to figure it out. And that to me seems where we've been kind of left. And you seem to be picking up the baton and saying, here's how states can define a partisan gerrymander and start to try to slay it. Is that a fair interpretation of where we're at from a legal standpoint?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think starting in 2012 with what I, back then I wrote a column and I called that the Great Gerrymander of 2012. At that time, a lot of us in the reform space had hoped there could be a uniform standard that could be defined by the Supreme Court that could apply to Republicans, could apply to Democrats, could apply to anyone who attempted to gain an advantage through gerrymandering. And the funny thing about the Supreme Court is that with the Gil versus Whitford case, and then later in a case non-involving Wisconsin called Rucho versus Common Cause, the Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the opinion, and he basically said, gerrymandering is bad. I would say if you look at his opinion, it sounds like he thinks it might violate the Constitution, and then said, we're just not going to go there. The word was non-justiciable. And non-justiciable is fancy Supreme Court speak for, we're just not going to get involved. It sure is a shame that this is happening. But then he also said that there's ways the states can deal with it, through courts, through citizen initiatives, through nonpartisan commissions. He listed these as ways that citizens and states could slay the gerrymander themselves.
And wasn't it in the dissent of that, was it Elena Kagan who seemed to start to try to lay out a roadmap for this? And from what I'm gathering from what you've written, it really does start with stop thinking about federal law and start thinking about what's in state law and go ahead and set up a state level definition.
That's right. So oddly enough, I would say that Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kagan on both sides of the opinions actually both started laying out logic on how one could do these things. Associate Justice Elena Kagan said that under the First Amendment, viewpoint discrimination is unconstitutional. Chief Justice Roberts said that under the 14th Amendment, voters should not have unequal power. And so they used the federal constitution to make these arguments. But these same ideas are in state constitutions around the country, and that includes Wisconsin. And so their arguments can be applied to state cases using state constitutions as guidance.
So you've laid out essentially a three-prong approach, and we've covered the first two. One is that states can and should define a partisan gerrymander at the state level. And second, that there are already protections written in Wisconsin law and in other state laws. And so essentially swap out the federal protection language for state protection language and again, lay the basework for states. But now the third prong, which I thought was interesting with this last go around with the conservative Wisconsin Supreme Court, they decided not to draw their own maps. And your point here is that courts have in the past, and they should again. I don't know why they didn't in this particular instance, but this is the point that you're making, is the court should draw the map based on those safeguards and standards.
That's right. When I talk about those constitutional protections, you can find them in Article 1 and Article 4 of the Wisconsin State Constitution. And there's also protection of communities of interest in Wisconsin law. I think that the reason that the Wisconsin Supreme Court didn't get involved just a few months ago in drawing lines themselves is that I would say that the swing justice on the court, Brian Hagedorn, I think that he's a conservative he comes off as a conservative who's true to his principles. And conservatives often say, we're not going to legislate from the bench. And one way to interpret that in a nonpartisan manner is to say, okay, there's a dispute between these two sides about drawing these lines. I, as a judge, shouldn't draw these lines. The parties involved should draw the lines. And so what Justice Hagedorn did in that case was, and the rest of the court as well, was consider the plans that were offered to them by the litigants, whether it's Governor Evers or by the General Assembly. And I would say that it was within the bounds of what you would imagine could happen in a dispute, which is to say, you guys give us your best offer and we will adjudicate. And in some ways, that's a non-aggressive approach that, say, assumes good faith on the part of the litigants on either side.
Yeah, that's a very good way of putting it. So we've laid out the three steps in there. I would like to go back to the protections one for just a moment, because I realize I forgot to ask kind of specifically what those protections are. For example, I think the one that most people would understand is to make a district contiguous. It shouldn't be all over the place and wrapping around other districts and things like that, that these things should be compact. What are some other examples of the protections that are already existing that Wisconsin and other states should be doing a better job of when they're redrawing their maps?
Right. So contiguity is something that is often taken for granted, but it's actually written into the Wisconsin Constitution in Article 4. So you should be able to, in some sense, to either walk across or in some cases in Wisconsin, swim across and stay within a district the whole time. That's contiguity. Compactness is it shouldn't be a funny shape where a circle is sort of this ideal perfect world shape and then a snaky shape is sort of the opposite. That's also in Article 4. Another thing that's in Article 4 is no splitting of pre-existing political boundaries. And this is an interesting one because the idea here is that cities and counties shouldn't be split. And my understanding is that in Wisconsin's 72 counties, the legislative map actually has 73 county splits, and so it has more splits than the number of counties that you have in Wisconsin. So that's a lot of splitting, and that appears to be pretty contrary to Article 4, Sections 4 and 5 of the Wisconsin Constitution.
I will tell you that it is, and I can tell you that from personal experience, and that it has always been maddening, and I think that's putting it mildly, that Republicans were able to get away with the original maps in 2011. I recall at the time having recently been booted from the legislature in 2010, and you know, watching the process unfold leading into 2011, the various county officials and municipal officials every 10 years as part of a cooperative effort, you know, they start putting all this data together so that, you know, the lines can be drawn in a way that don't split the counties. And instead, what you see exactly is you saw either the packing or the cracking. Like in Eau Claire, it used to be part of two different districts. They put it all into one. So there was one Democratic island. In Sheboygan, on the other hand, they split the city down one of the main streets, and now Sheboygan didn't have a Democratic representative at all. And again, for the casual listener, this seems so basic. And yet we had to wait until this recent Supreme Court election to have the possibility that Article 4 would be followed. And I, again, as somebody who works in a gerrymandering project, I don't mean to sound so, I guess, emotional about it, but it has to be just perplexing to you sometimes as to it. Pardon the phrase, how did they get away with it?
Well, let's be fair here. Democrats or Republicans are perfectly capable of drawing a gerrymander, and not too far from you in Illinois. Certainly Democrats there have shown quite a capacity for it.
Absolutely. And the question applies both ways.
So right. So there's two parts of this. So the way I would think of it is there's process and there's having standards. And in most states in the United States, sadly, we have a process where legislators draw lines that they themselves then run for office under. And what that means is this process of self-dealing, where they get to draw their own lines, run under those lines, and then draw more lines for themselves a decade later. So process, in that way, is fundamentally what I would call self-dealing. And then there's having concrete standards. And one of the difficulties, and again, this is just to be fair, that these standards are not always explicitly drawn into law because the tactics have gotten more extreme, because the software has gotten more advanced, because the partisanship has gotten worse. In these circumstances, these rules get pushed to the limit. And as a result, courts have to catch up, and courts have to take a look and say, well, we said that everyone should be treated uniformly without special laws. We said that communities shouldn't be split. Now let's take a look at the situation and see if these principles have been violated. And so when circumstances change, judges often will adapt to the new circumstances.
Let me ask in closing about a little bit more about the Princeton gerrymandering project. Can you tell us just a little bit about what it does, its background? I guess what I'm really thinking is, I mean, do other states call on your expertise? Is this something that we need to be knocking on Janet Protasiewicz's door and say, hey, go talk to these people? Tell us about the project.
Well, the gerrymandering project here at Princeton began as a nonpartisan effort to apply math and statistics and computer modeling to understand fair districting and to understand how different groups could be treated differently from one another, and to really find ways to quantify these sorts of offenses, and to also merge math and the law to come up with fair districting. My group and I here work with people around the country. We've worked with courts, with good government groups, in all cases, nonpartisans. We never work with political parties, and we've helped, or we hope we've helped, in places as disparate as Michigan, Virginia, Missouri, New Mexico. And so the general goal is to be of service. Certainly the State Court of Wisconsin has many resources available to it. And I would say that there are lots of good people, including within the state of Wisconsin, who could be of use to them. So I think that they're doing an important job, and they're going to have no shortage of high quality expertise to help them.
Professor Sam Wong, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate hearing this level of background to help us see that what lies ahead of us, this challenge, is in fact doable, thanks to the work that folks like you are doing. Thank you again for your time.
Thanks, and best of luck.
If you want to learn more about the Princeton Gerrymandering Project, go to gerrymander.princeton.edu. Again, gerrymander, G-E-R-R-Y-M-A-N-D-E-R, gerrymander.princeton.edu. And we again appreciate very much his expertise talking to him on Friday afternoon about ungerrymandering the state. It can be done. There is a legal basis for it to be done. And so a case is going to come before a newly progressively controlled state Supreme Court sometime after August, where perhaps by 2024, but maybe by 2026, Wisconsin has a representative democracy once again. More after this. You're up north. She screamed. No, she did not. Kristen Lyerly kept it play it cool today so far and joins us for today's music break and history lesson. Dr. Lyerly, how are you?
So far, I'm playing it cool. You never know what's going to happen.
This is a birthday for Katrina of Katrina and the Waves and Walking on Sunshine, their one hit. Katrina Leskanich is 63 years old today. There are a lot of birthdays today. We've got... let's see, Brian Setzer of the Stray Cats. Remember the Stray Cats?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
We actually saw him perform live once in Reno, of all places. And he and his band were just, they're amazing. Just.
I saw them too at Centennial Park right during the Olympics, the night before Centennial Park was bombed. Crazy.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just another story.
Yep. Kenneth Babyface Edmonds is also 64 years old today. There's a bunch of M's on my birthday screen here. Mandy Moore is 39. Maren Morris is 33. The actress Daisy Ridley from Star Wars, she played the character Rey. And I thought she did a fantastic job there. She's 31 years old today. This is the anniversary that John Madden was born on this day in 1936. He passed away a couple of years ago. And this is the day the Titanic began its maiden voyage. And I think we all know how that went. They were not walking on sunshine.
Wah, wah.
They were laying on a door. Well, one of them was laying on a door and wouldn't make room for the other one. Let's see, more music history. It was on this day, still a little bitter about that. On this day in 1976, the number one album was Frampton Comes Alive by Peter Frampton. It would be there for 10 weeks throughout the course of the year.
I saw Peter Frampton in concert too.
Did you really?
Mm-hmm. Here in Wisconsin.
How long
in the
ago?
Dells. Oh gosh, maybe 10 years ago. He was great.
Oh yeah.
I've never seen so many old white guys in the aisle dancing. It was really fun.
I mean, that album was just a juggernaut back in 1976. Two things happened on this day in 1970. First, Elton John's self-titled album was released, and it included one of his first hits, Your Song. But also, it was a little eclipsed on that day in 1970 when Paul McCartney announced that he was leaving the Beatles. So that was kind of the big music news of that day. On this day in 1925, in New York City, The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald was published for the first time, a novel written largely in St. Paul. On this day in 1990, Public Enemy released their third album, Fear of a Black Planet. It became the first hip-hop album to sell over a million copies in its release week, and included Fight the Power. By comparison, it was on this day in 1956, while performing to an all-white audience at a segregated show in Birmingham, Alabama, that Nat King Cole was attacked by four members of the Ku Klux Klan who rushed the stage to assault him. Cole suffered a back injury, was treated at a hospital, but returned that night to play his second show, this time to an all-black audience. The attackers received the maximum sentence, which was 6 months in jail. Also on this day in 1865, Confederate General Robert E. Lee addressed his troops for the last time, a day after his surrender to Union forces. On this day in 1990, a tribe called Quest released their debut album, People's Instinctive Travels and the Path of Rhythm, including the single Can I Kick It?
Can I kick it? Can I kick it? Can I kick it?
Q-Tip of a Tribe Called Quest. He was born Jonathan Davis. Can you imagine if you named your kid Q-Tip and that was on the birth certificate?
But, I'm sure somebody's out there.
But this is his birthday. He is 53. And the number one album on this day was Depeche Mode's eighth album, Songs of Faith and Devotion. So we had all kinds of things coming on there. We could have played more music from Mandy Moore, Maren Morris. Babyface is a favorite of mine. Brian Setzer.
Babyface. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Aaron, cue up some Babyface later in the show so we can watch that rock out.
Well, I don't know that we necessarily say rock out. I can enjoy music without dancing in the aisles. Especially if I know somebody's going to talk about it on the radio, you know.
Hey, it's there to be enjoyed.
There you go. I wanted to pass along one comment from our Facebook page from Steve Gustafson, who was asking in our discussion on gerrymandering, were we saying that there is a case heading to the Wisconsin Supreme Court that could help create fair maps? And the answer is no, not yet, but it's being prepared as we speak. Or I shouldn't say it could be they. There could be multiple lawsuits. I know Law Forward has said that they are working on one. So there will certainly be a challenge, Kristen. The real key is whether we see it by 2024 or 2026.
Yeah, I've heard of another organization out of Washington, D.C. that has one ready to go as well. So the next couple of months are going to be really interesting.
Yeah. And when I was asked by somebody when we had everybody over for Easter, and when somebody asked about 2024, if that was realistic, I said, that actually, I wish I could be optimistic, but I'm not, because it's rare for the U.S. Supreme Court to basically overrule a state Supreme Court they are normally respected. But as we know, that didn't happen in Wisconsin with this U.S. Supreme Court. You had Governor Evers submitting a map that the state Supreme Court, you know, had at first adopted, but then Republicans challenged it to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the right-wing justices on the U.S. Supreme Court said that Governor Evers' map was illegal because it created an extra black majority assembly district. And so it had to go back, and they ended up picking the map that the Republicans had drawn up because there was one too many black majority assembly districts. I'm still shocked by that one.
Yeah, and still shocked by the fact that anything could happen. It just feels like all protocol and common sense is out the window, and truly anything could happen these days because of our political situation.
Yes, but as a result, that's where we bring in you know, the folks from Motherhood for Good in our next hour, Nicole Slavin and Aaron Phillips, who are going to talk about the importance of staying involved. And I mean, you could do the same thing. You worked very hard on, you know, setting up things for November and then for this election, but yet here you are 6 days later. You'll probably be involved 7 days, 8 days, 9 days later. And I think it's a fair question, Kristen. Why? You won the state Supreme Court election. Why should you still stay engaged and not just go back to your normal quiet life?
It isn't about a victory in one arena. It's about everything. It's about all of us. It's about building community and finding that place where we're headed in the right direction and we're solving problems and we're working together again. So I'll always be involved because I can't not, Pat, and the same goes for you.
So true. So there's a reason you don't get up at 4 a.m. unless you're motivated for something. And yeah, that's definitely the case. How was your holiday weekend?
It was so nice. The weather. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. We were outside most of the day. My kids are indoor people and they took the bags out. We were playing bag toss last night.
Oh, bean bags. Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. We had a fire. It was fantastic.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Good. See, it's coming. The long winter has come to an end, metaphorically on election day, and now for reals as well.
Best week ever.
Take a break for good. Take a break for news. Motherhood for Good is part of what we have next hour. You're up north.